Here comes the Zen stuff, Joe says. You're trying to control your throw and you can't. That's when he tells me to try throwing with my eyes closed. All righty. I squeeze my eyes, wind up, and let fly. Thwack! My tomahawk is buried in the log a few inches from the playing card. Wow, that's... Before I can finish, Joe pivots. He windmills his arm and thwack, 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 buries three hawks in three different targets. One splits the playing card right down the middle. Joe grins. You have to enter yourself and let the rhythm come. Once you do that, you can do all kinds of crazy things. Humans are amazing throwers. We are unique among all animals in our ability to throw projectiles at high speed and with incredible accuracy. So says Dr. Neil Roach of George Washington University, lead author of a 2013 study that tackles the mystery of why, out of all other primates on the planet, we're the only ones who can kill prey with a lethal throw. It's not our muscles. Chimpanzees are extraordinary athletes and proportionately much stronger, but even though they're our closest genetic cousins, they're rotten pitchers. You can train a chimp to throw, but the most heat he'll ever muster is about 20 miles per hour. For a little leaguer, that's a joke. 12-year-old boys can throw three times as fast, with much sharper precision. Softball star Jenny Finch routinely tops 70 miles per hour, and that's underhand. So what do we have that chimps don't? A shoulder full of rubbery gunk, fascia and ligaments and stretchy tendons. Cocking your arm, Roach explains, is like pulling back a slingshot. When this energy is then released, it powers the very rapid rotation of the upper arm, which is the fastest motion the human body produces, up to 9,000 degrees of rotation per second in professional pitchers. A fast throw isn't just muscular effort, but a three-stage uncoiling of elastic force. Step with the foot opposite the throwing hand, rotate your hips, then your shoulders, and whip by popping the joints in the arm, wrist, and hand. We weren't always equipped with such howitzers, Roach adds. About 2 million years ago, our ancestors developed a few key structural changes that changed us from climbers and scavengers into living catapults. Our waists got a little wider, our shoulders a little lower, our wrists more flexible, and our upper arms a bit more rotated. Once we got the hang of our wobble power and learned to put a point on a stick, we became not only the deadliest creature on the planet, but the smartest. The better we threw, the more intelligent we became. This ability to produce powerful throws was crucial to the intensification of hunting, Roach explains. Success at hunting allowed our ancestors to become part-time carnivores, eating more calorie-rich meat and fat, and dramatically improving the quality of their diet. This dietary change led to seismic shifts in our ancestors' biology, allowing them to grow larger bodies, larger brains, and to have more children. Bigger brains led to a revolutionary new skill, one that would become the foundation of all human achievement. We learned to aim not only where food was, but where food wasn't. Kudus and rabbits dart off in mad zigzags, meaning a hunter has to mentally process the timing and distance of three different bodies moving through space, his own, his prey's, and his weapons, to calculate the exact point where spear meets quarry, or where Allied gunshot meets German paratrooper on Crete. That kind of sequential thought requires intellect of a higher order, says William H. Calvin, PhD, a professor of neurobiology at the University of Washington and a specialist in the evolution of the human brain. Specifically, he's talking about imagination, the ability to project into the future, visualize possibilities, think in the abstract. That's why Calvin believes language, literature, medicine, and even love are all connected to our ancient ability to hit a hare at 20 paces. Throwing is about finding order in chaos, he says. The more you're able to think in sequence, the more ideas you're able to string together. You can add more words to your vocabulary. You can combine unrelated concepts. You can plan for the future. And you can keep track of social relationships. But wait, aren't sequence thinking and idea combining the kind of tinkering there's no time for in A Race for Survival? Exactly. And that's why, when it came to throwing tomahawks, I was better off with a blindfold. With primal functions, education and execution don't mix. Your brain processes the movement, but your body carries it out. So once you've grooved a move into your fascia, get out of its way. It reacts and remembers. Chapter 11. Things you do come back to you, as though they knew the way. Rogers and Hart, Where or When? Tomahawks and spears weren't the weapons of choice for the firm, but luckily, wobble power works just as well with a finger. When the Heavenly Twins began training Churchill's first class of dirty tricksters, Bill Fairbairn showed them how it's done. Fairbairn yanked his pistol and clenched it like, well, like an idiot. He didn't even aim the thing. Everyone knows you have to lock out your arms and steady the pistol with both hands as you peer down the sights. But Fairbairn just stood there, his knees bent as though they were about to buckle. He clutched the pistol as if he were trying to crush it in his fist and barely raised it to his waist. He looked nothing like an expert marksman or a seasoned cop. He looked more like a confused old man who suddenly found a pistol in his pocket and had no idea how it got there. "Now this," he said, "is how you win a gunfight. You're crazy if you think you won't be terrified when you face a man who's trying to kill you," Fairbairn explained. "But that's okay. Humans are terrific at turning terror into a weapon. You just need to tap into your natural ability to aim by instinct." Fairbairn believed instinctive aim is what made Wild West gunslingers so deadly, and one of his proteges actually went west to find out. Rex Applegate was a U.S. Army lieutenant with unusual credentials. As a boy in Yoncalla, Oregon, he'd chuck bricks in the air as targets for his uncle, a professional trickshot artist. "These people did not use the sights for many of their acts," Applegate noted. Yet when he joined the army, he found that old-timers like his uncle were better shots than his instructors. Frontiersmen like Wild Bill Hickok had heavier weapons and no formal training, but their quick-draw skills were astonishing. Wild Bill was an authentic Western gunman who actually killed a lot of men in combat, Applegate learned. I was still searching for that essential fact. How did they do it? The army assigned Applegate to study close combat techniques, and one of his first stops was Wild Bill's final stomping grounds in Deadwood, South Dakota. In the county courthouse, Applegate found a packet of Wild Bill's papers. One was a letter from an admirer asking, in effect, "How did you kill these men? What was your method or technique?" Applegate relates. "That was exactly what I was looking for." Luckily, Hickok had never mailed his response. In Hickok's own handwriting, Applegate read, "I raised my hand to eye level, like pointing a finger, and fired." Like pointing a finger. This was very intriguing, Applegate would recall, but it wasn't made clear to me until I started my training in combat handgun techniques under a couple of gentlemen named William E. Fairbairn and Eric A. Sykes. The twins, it turned out, had come up with the same technique after a lucky accident. One night, 15 of their Shanghai policemen had raided a crime gang's headquarters. When Fairbairn inspected the building the next morning, he found it ringed with head-high booby-trap wires. His officers had passed right under without seeing them. In a flash of insight, Fairbairn understood why. Whenever they tensed, they instinctively dropped into a crouch. It must be the same reason, Fairbairn realized, They also clutch their pistols in a death grip. You will be keyed up to the highest pitch and will be grasping your pistol with almost convulsive force. If you have to fire, your instinct will be to do it as quickly as possible, and you will probably do it with a bent arm, possibly even from the level of the hip. The whole affair may take place in a bad light or none at all, Fairbairn predicted. It may be that a bullet whizzes past you, and that you will experience momentary stupefaction, which is due to the shock of the explosion at very short range of the shot just fired by your opponent. What Fairbairn was observing would be identified years later as the sympathetic nervous system response, more commonly known as the fight or flight reflex. Your knees bend, your heart pounds, your hands clench and jerk up in front of you, your vision tunnels toward one threat, and your body squares to face it. This is your lower brain, your animal self, coiling you like a spring to either strike or sprint for cover. Before Fairbairn arrived in Shanghai, police guidelines dictated you should ignore your animal self and get composed before shooting. But while you're composing, the other guy is firing. If you take much longer than a third of a second to fire your first shot, Fairbairn warned, you will not be the one to tell the newspaper about it. No wonder 9 Shanghai patrolmen were killed in a single year. There is not time, Fairbairn realized, to put yourself into some special stance or to align the sights of the pistol, and any attempt to do so places you at the mercy of a quicker opponent. You can't fight natural instinct, he decided, but you can make natural instinct fight for you. So the twins came up with a new fear-as-a-weapon approach, and brought it with them when they returned to Britain. The man who can use his weapon quickly and accurately from any position without using the sights is the one who will stand the best chance of not going out feet first, the twins announced. It can be done, and it is not so very difficult. The trick is making your pistol an extension of your fascia, and for that, you only need to point your finger. When you sense menace, your body craves balance. That's why a scare puts you instinctively into the pose of a tightrope walker. Knees bent, hands up. But there's another effect. Your arm can locate a threat like a compass needle finding true north. The biomechanics make sense. To avoid getting knocked over by an attacker, your body weight has to be ready to instantly shift from 2 points of support, your feet on the ground, to 3. Your feet plus the attacker you're about to hold at arm's length. Your hand can't wait for a command. It needs its own defensive directional system, a fascia-based response. Fairbairn called it the impulse of the master eye. Pick a spot on the far wall, he'd instruct his recruits. Cock your thumb and finger like an imaginary pistol. Now pull. Yank up your hand and quick draw toward your target. Don't think, don't aim, just move. Observe carefully now what has taken place, Fairbairn would say. Your forefinger, as intended, will be pointing to the mark you are facing squarely. To convert that impulse into deadly force, Fairbairn concluded, you just need to point your gun the same way. We were not taught to hold the gun out at arm's length or with 2 hands, but to draw the gun and hold it tucked into your navel with the gun pointing straight ahead, one of the twins' students, Robert Shepherd, would explain. Wherever you looked, your gun moved round towards the target you were looking at. SOE recruits, who'd handled a gun before, bristled at the point-and-shoot system. It was ugly and humiliating. They didn't look like brave lawmen, aiming carefully with locked-out arms and 2 firm hands. They looked like scared punks trying to sneak off a shot without getting spotted. But Fairbairn's partner, Bill Sykes, knew how to deal with doubters. I've seen that chap turn round with his back facing the target and hit the bullseye from between his legs, Shepherd would recall. I've seen him do that. Chapter 12. Now, Ah Hing, I'm going to teach you how to fight like a woman. Grandmaster Ip Man, Bruce Lee's teacher. Rex Applegate got off to a bumpy start with the twins. He was a massive guy, 6'3" hardened into 230 pounds of muscle from a boyhood in Oregon logging towns, and so skilled with his fists and trigger finger that even as a young second lieutenant, he was hand-picked by Colonel Wild Bill Donovan to teach stealth fighting to the espionage and sabotage unit that would become the Central Intelligence Agency. Word had it that two old Brits were the best gutter fighters in the world, so Wild Bill sent Applegate to find out what the twins were up to. "We soon sized each other up," Applegate recalled, and he was unimpressed. Maybe Fairbairn knew a little judo and was flashy with a pistol, but in a real scrap, Applegate would smother the shrimp. Fairbairn must have sensed what he was thinking, because during a demonstration, he invited Applegate to come forward. "I want you to attack me," Fairbairn offered, "just like you are going to kill me." Applegate was 30 years younger and nearly 100 pounds heavier, but, more important, he knew how to dismantle these so-called martial artists. You psych them out with some noise, then run them over before they have time to set up any of their little flippy moves. "The first thing to do when on the offensive is to weaken the opponent's balance mentally and physically," Applegate explained. "I let out a roar and went for him." The soldiers in the front row had to scramble out of the way as Applegate came sailing back at them. "I had been in some barroom brawls and held my own," a stunned Applegate would recall. "It got my attention." Whatever the twins were teaching, it was different from anything Applegate had seen before. "We are reverting to the type of individual warfare of earlier times," Fairbairn explained. "Your strength won't help," he told Applegate. "Neither will boxing, wrestling, or most anything you might have learned in a karate dojo. Those are just games, with made-up rules and show-offy skills. You can break a board with your foot? Big deal. Try it on the twins, and you'll go home with that foot in a cast. You're a Greco-Roman wrestling champion? Super!" Fairbairn could cripple a wrestler as easily as he'd manhandled Applegate. "Stay on your feet," Applegate learned. "A cardinal rule of this kind of combat is never go to the ground." But wait, wouldn't mixed martial artists later claim that 90% of all fights end up on the ground and win bouts all the time by bringing the action to the mat? "Very true," Fairbairn would reply. "And if you find yourself inside an octagon with a cushioned floor and a Brazilian in surf shorts, then go ahead and grapple. But in a real fight, with no rules, no ref, no tap-outs, no guarantee the other guy doesn't have a weapon, the ground is where you go to die. If an attacker gets you down, you'd better grab his testicles, jam a thumb in his eyeball, tear his ear off with your teeth, whatever it takes to kick free and scramble back up so you can use the bronco kick, one of Fairbairn's pet moves, jumping on the guy's chest until his ribs are jelly." "Real violence isn't about sportsmanship," Fairbairn stressed. "It's about survival. You're not shaking his hand and wishing him well. You're hoping he's still lying there when you leave." "Boxing and wrestling aren't natural forms of combat," the twins explained. "They're natural forms of peacocking, created by and for men to showboat two unique male attributes, bulk and upper body strength. Otherwise, they're useless. No human in the wild would ever throw a punch if he could avoid it, not even against another human. Why risk breaking all those fragile bones and knuckle joints, or jabbing out an arm that can be trapped, twisted, and snapped?" But that's not even the big red flag. There's a more glaring giveaway that boxing and wrestling are just recreation. Girls and old guys aren't good at them. As a rule of thumb, performance aberration in a basic skill is a good way to evaluate whether it's natural to a species. When you spot a giant ability gap between ages and genders, You know you're looking at nurture, not nature. Male and female geese differ in size, but not in speed. Otherwise, migration would be mayhem. Same with trout. If males rocketed past the females, they'd always be first to eat, last to be eaten, and on their way to a disastrous shortage of spawning partners. Gender and age differences don't disappear, of course, but they're tremendously diminished. Especially among humans. Compared with other animals, men and women are remarkably alike. We're roughly the same size and shape, and share the same biological weaponry. Men aren't specially equipped with horns, fangs, or giant racks of antlers, like the males of other species, and they don't dwarf women. Men are only about 15% bigger, not 50%, like male gorillas. We need to be similar because, for most of our existence, we shared similar jobs. Humans survived for millions of years as hunter-gatherers, ranging across the terrain together in search of edible plants, diggable roots, and catchable game. We worked together, and as couples, we stayed together. Humans choose one mate at a time, and we do it peacefully. That's why our courtships are a dance, not a death match. Apes and elks battle for the right to reproduce and take multiple mates by force. But humans have a more runway model approach. Rather than fight, we flaunt. Men primp themselves up to look like hearty specimens and sturdy providers, then wait for the women to make their choices. That's one of the necessities of monogamy. Apes can afford to tear one another apart, since the alpha male ends up with a harem. But in a system of one-to-one mating, courtship can't conclude with half the males on life support. We're creatures of restraint, of endurance and elasticity, and that's where men and women, old and young, are most alike. When it comes to tests of endurance, like distance running and swimming, the performance difference between ages and genders is even smaller than the difference in our size. It's only about 10%. A 25-year-old man wasn't the one who battled through 53 hours of jellyfish stings and bruising currents to become the first to swim from Cuba to Florida without a shark cage. It was a senior citizen, 64-year-old Diana Nyad. The fastest female ever to swim the 23-plus mile English Channel was just 30 minutes behind the fastest man. And a 30-year-old bankruptcy lawyer named Amelia Boone nearly won the world's toughest mudder obstacle race in 2012, covering 90 miles and more than 300 obstacles to finish second overall and 10 miles ahead of the guy in third. Middle-aged women are likewise no strangers to the lead pack in ultramarathons. Pam Reed was 41 when she outran all the men to win the 135-mile Badwater Ultra across Death Valley in 2002. The following year, she returned and did it again. Diana Finkel was just shy of 40 when she led for the first 90 miles of the brutally hard Hard Rock 100, finishing second overall. With a little more practice, the same could be true for throwing. Anatomically, there's no reason women can't fire a ball as hard as men. Strength and physique aren't the issue. When researchers tested Aboriginal Australian girls who grow up hunting alongside boys, they found the difference in top-end throwing velocity was only about 20%. Monet Davis, the 13-year-old South Philadelphia schoolgirl who pitched shutouts against all-boy teams to lead her squad to the Little League World Series, routinely fires 70-mile-per-hour fastballs, even though she's only 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighs 111 pounds. Hip rotation is the key. Whipping a rock is simple but sequential, so if you don't practice the link between opening the hips and releasing the arm, you'll lose the knack or never learn it in the first place. The reason women don't throw as well as men, it seems, is because they don't throw as much. But the raw weaponry is still there, and it's the best weaponry we've got. That was the twin special talent. For men and women alike, they found a way to turn throwing into fighting. "What's the worst fix you can find yourself in?" Fairbairn asked Applegate. "Jump from behind," Applegate replied. "Someone gets the drop on you. Now you've got a gun in your back and your hands in the air." "Fine, show me." Fairbairn offered himself up as a prisoner, turning around and clasping his hands behind his head. Applegate approached warily. He pulled his sidearm, jammed it hard into Fairbairn's spine, and Fairbairn helped Applegate up off the floor and handed him back his gun. "Care to see it again?" For the second time, Fairbairn turned and put his hands in the air. He spun around more slowly this time, sweeping the gun away with his left hand and grabbing Applegate's chin with his right, finishing him off with a knee to the groin and a shove to the ground. Even though Fairbairn was moving at demonstration speed, Applegate couldn't stop him. "Strange as it may seem," Applegate learned, "the gunman cannot think fast enough to pull the trigger and make a hit before your body is out of the line of fire." "Now look right at me," Fairbairn ordered. Applegate stuck the empty pistol in Fairbairn's belly and curled his finger around the trigger, watching Fairbairn's eyes for a flicker of intent. Fairbairn twisted and slapped, knocking the gun away before Applegate could click the trigger. He bent back Applegate's wrist, driving the big man to his knees and yanking away the gun. Fairbairn's feet never moved. All he did was dip his knees, pivot his hips, and bend his elbow. "The body twist is the basis of all disarming," Applegate realized. But that was just the beginning. For the twins, the body twist was the basis of everything. In the jungle, body twist is so potent that baboons use it as a white flag of surrender. To avoid a fight, they let their trunk and abdominal muscle sag, indicating their most powerful weapon has been deactivated. Humans, Fairbairn demonstrated, come pre-equipped with the same primate power. Fairbairn ran Applegate through a series of gutter fighting moves, breaking free from a stranglehold, recovering from a knockdown, bringing a bigger man to the ground and, of course, the matchbox attack. All Fairbairn's tactics had three things in common. They were quick, easy, and appalling. Any individual in combat in which his life is at stake very quickly reverts to the animal, it dawned on Applegate. After a few seconds, and especially after he has been hit or jarred by his opponent, the bloodlust is so aroused that from then on his combat is instinctive. Take the matchbox. Once you know it, you can walk down a dodgy street at night or escape from gunpoint in the back of a car with nothing more lethal in your pocket than a cell phone. Or, in Fairbairn's day, a small cardboard box of matches. If you find yourself in an apprehensive situation, stick close to the walls on the right side of the street and casually slip your right hand into your jacket pocket. Wrap your fist around the phone with the top just below your thumb and index finger. Damn, you are right to be nervous, because here comes trouble. Someone's moving in fast with, what, a gun, a knife, in his hand. The phone will now save your life, but only because of body twist. "Parry the gun away from your body with your left forearm," Fairbairn instructs. "Now bring out the phone. By clenching it in your fist, the bones in your hand compress into a hard block. Turning your body from the hip, strike your opponent hard on the left side of his face, as near to the jawbone as possible. You barely need to move your arm. Keep your shoulder pinned to your side and come up hard with the forearm, letting your hips do the work. The odds of knocking your opponent unconscious by this method are at least 2-1, Fairbairn adds. The fact that this can be accomplished with a matchbox is not well known, and for this reason is not likely to raise your opponent's suspicion of your movements. Applegate quickly grasped the power of Fairbairn's discovery. Body twist, like instinctive aim, works for anyone and can be mastered fast. You can pick up the basics in an afternoon, and perfect them with just 10 minutes or so of daily practice. You don't need years of training in a dojo and a drawer full of colored belts. What you need most, Applegate realized, is to remember what it's like to fight for real. In our quest to become more humane, we've forgotten that self-defense is a survival skill, not a spectator sport. Fighting has been turned into entertainment and toned down so much, it's more about what you can't do than what you can. You can only fight guys your size, with padded gloves, under a referee's supervision and a physician's care, for 3 minutes at a time before taking a 1 minute break and sitting on your own stool in your own corner of a roped-off ring. You've got to keep your feet on the judo tatami and tie back your hair, and you can't lock your fingers together or kick your way out of a grip. Even in the wild west of ultimate fighting, it's forbidden to bite, spit, curse, claw, pinch, throat strike, headbutt, flesh twist, eye gouge, hair pull, fish hook, groin grab, heel kick a kidney, head kick a grounded opponent, or fake an injury. You must wear officially sanctioned shorts and be clean and present a tidy appearance. Clean and tidy? We've become so civilized over the past 100 years, we're denying what it was like for the previous 2 million. Worst of all, we've mothballed our deadliest weapon and taken our fascia out of the fight. Except, as Fairbairn discovered long ago, when the sun went down on a certain Chinese waterfront. Fairbairn first heard about Wing Chun while recovering from the beating he suffered when he first arrived in Shanghai as a new policeman in 1907. The name means humming a song in the springtime, and it nicely captures Wing Chun's ease and apparent languor. Your stance is barely recognizable as a stance. You don't put up your dukes to protect your head or clench your hands into tiger claws. Your hands are so loose and open, you could be playing patty cake. But beneath that effortless appearance is a shrewd insight into the science of elastic energy. If you've heard of Wing Chun, it's probably thanks to Hollywood star Robert Downey Jr., who credits it with saving his life. Downey was one of the most promising young actors of the 1980s, but by 1996, he'd become a toxic menace. He was arrested for cocaine, for heroin, for crack, for carrying a concealed magnum pistol, for breaking out of court-ordered rehab. One day he was arraigned on drug charges, then arrested again hours later for stumbling into a neighbor's home in an apparent heroin stupor and passing out in his underwear in one of the children's bedrooms. It's like I have a loaded gun in my mouth and my fingers on the trigger, and I like the taste of the gunmetal, Downey said shortly before he was sentenced to a year in prison and led off with his hands shackled to his waist. After he was released, Downey discovered Wing Chun and began training for hours at a time, often 5 days a week. Something about Wing Chun made him feel balanced and alive. It wasn't the discipline. It was the sense that his body was finally doing what it was supposed to. Wing Chun teaches you what to concentrate on, whether you're here or out in the world dealing with problems, the actor explained once when a reporter joined him for a workout. It's second nature for me now. I don't even get to the point where there's a problem. You don't want to fight the truck, Downey's instructor added. You want to step out of the way. Legend has it that Wing Chun is the only martial art invented by a woman. Ying Mui, it said, was studying at the Shaolin Temple when it was attacked by Qing Dynasty soldiers. The temple was destroyed and monks were slaughtered, but the five elders, including Ying Mui, managed to escape. While Ying Mui was hiding in the forest, she saw a crane being ambushed by a wildcat at the side of a stream. There was no way the crane, with its two awkward legs, could survive the cat's fangs, razor claws, and four-legged athleticism. Yet it did, pivoting and twisting its wings until the cat was defeated by its own ferocity. The parallels to Ying Mui's own situation were unmistakable, and she began transforming the lesson into a fighting style that would make her as formidable as any man. That meant solving the toughest puzzle of any martial art, surviving inside the trapping zone. Whenever your opponent is close enough to grab you, you've entered his trapping zone. Boxers depend on the length of their jab and the quickness of their feet to escape the trapping zone, while karate and taekwondo teach long, snapping kicks. The goal is to pop your opponent from a distance and keep as far from his hands as possible. The trapping zone rewards bulk and brute force. It neutralizes speed and skill. It's the big man's friend and the little guy's nightmare. Yet oddly, it's where the feminine style of Wing Chun works best. Wing Chun tells you to step right into the trap and make yourself at home. Don't bob and weave or even turn sideways to offer a smaller target. Just face your attacker, square up your feet, and wait for him to do his worst. But first, make sure to mark your center line. The essence of Wing Chun is the belief that human power is strongest when it spirals up from your feet through the center of your body. You can access that centerline energy by following these four steps. Number one, slide your feet out to shoulder width. Number two, sink your thighs into the slightest of squats. Number three, cross your open hands in front of your crotch. Number four, then raise them chest high in that most instinctive of defensive positions, an X. Now you're ready for sticky hands to turn your opponent's trapping zone into your own. Sticky hands is next level wobble power. It takes your attacker's force, merges it with your own, and slams the doubled up energy right back at him. The key is body connection. As soon as he starts throwing punches, you lightly stick your hands to his, deflecting the blows rather than blocking them. When he cracks a hard right at your eye, you divert it with your left wrist and use his force to pivot you like a wheel around an axle. Now it's your turn to hit, using the momentum of his push to power your right arm. He's belting himself in the face with your fist. The hands are swinging doors, built on the fortress of legs, the great Wing Chun grandmaster Ip Man liked to tell his students. Ip Man did not move a great deal, one of his followers observed. When someone punched at him, he moved just enough to avoid it. But when he attacked, he went straight for his opponent's center, either striking him or making him lose his balance. Ip Man was just as stingy with his feet. The higher your foot, the more compromised your balance. So Ip Man only kicked low. Never those big, crowd-pleasing headshots you see in tournaments. Only short bug stompers aimed at your knee, crotch, chin, or ankle. Wing Chun isn't a spectator sport. It's a science of crippling force designed to end fights fast by hitting quickest where it hurts the most. William Fairbairn was exactly the kind of guy who wasn't supposed to be learning Wing Chun. China was suspicious of outsiders even when times were good, and the early 1900s were anything but. Chinese fighting secrets were for Chinese only, not to be shared with foreigners who could use the arts against them. But even though he was a blue-eyed Brit who'd been in Shanghai only a few months, Fairbairn had a chip to play. One of the duties of the Empress's security and intelligence force was to recover royal antiquities pillaged during the Boxer Rebellion, that disastrous uprising by Chinese militants against foreign influence in 1899. Fairbairn was a great resource for finding lost booty. Between his raids on underworld dens, his contacts in the British military, and his relationship with the European nationals he helped protect, he could get leads on lost treasures the Empress's men had no hope of finding. In return, Fairbairn was allowed to train with Sui Jingdong, the Wing Chun master who taught the Empress Dowager's bodyguards. Under Sui Jingdong's tutelage, Fairbairn learned something surprising. Violence has a pretty thin encyclopedia. Every way you can think of to punch a windpipe or knee a groin, someone else figured it out 10,000 years ago. For self-defense, that was great news. If Fairbairn could master sticky hands, he could download every conceivable attack into his fascia memory and turn his body into an automatic response system. Like instinctive aim, sticky hands takes your higher brain out of the fight and activates your animal self. When an attacker grabs your wrist, up comes your elbow. If he tries to tackle you around the waist, your foot takes out his knee before he gets there. You don't need to think or even see, just react. For the Shanghai police, often facing long odds in dark basements, fascia-powered fighting was a lifesaver. And when Fairbairn and Sykes brought it back with them to Britain, they found it was just as effective for the women and poets and professors about to be dropped behind German lines on sabotage missions. "Sykes was the instructor who taught me silent killing," recalled Nancy Wake, the Australian party girl who became one of the SO's best agents. Nancy's specialties were strolling past Gestapo officers in France to chuck grenades through the door and rescuing downed Allied fighter pilots by using her sex appeal and ice-cold nerve to distract checkpoint guards. "I'd slink right up and purr, 'Do you want to search me?' Nancy would recall. God, what a flirtatious little bastard I was." The Gestapo nicknamed the mystery woman the White Mouse and put her at the top of its most wanted list. But Nancy was uncatchable. 17 times, she successfully led British fighters all the way across the Pyrenees to freedom. "If a German came at me, I'd kick him in the three-piece service and chop him in the side of the neck." Once, when her resistance band was surrounded, Nancy shot her way out and stole a bike, pedaling more than 125 miles through the night to safety. When a German sentry blocked her escape during an arms plant raid, the mouse's hands came up just the way Sykes had taught her. "Whack!" recalled Nancy. "It killed him, all right." Miraculously, Nancy Wake survived the war and lived to a fiery age 98. During a post-war dinner in France, she heard the waiter mutter under his breath that he preferred Germans to the rotten English. Nancy followed him to the kitchen, hit him Sykes-style, and knocked him cold. When the manager rushed over, Nancy's dinner companion advised him to walk away or she'd drop him next. "There had been nothing violent about my nature before the war," Nancy shrugged. "The enemy made me tough." A mouse who thrives inside the trapping zone. What a perfect bookend for Ying Wei, the battling abbess who 300 years earlier proved that women could fight as well as men. Except the origins of Wing Chun, it turns out, are a little more complicated and a lot more Greek. Deep within the labyrinth on the island of Crete, Theseus felt his way through the dark stone maze, nudging his feet past the gnawed corpses of men and women who'd come before. He was just a teenager, with no help or weapons. Turning a corner, he came face to face with the Minotaur, half man, half bull, and hungry for human blood. A new art was about to be born. Much weaker in strength than the Minotaur, Theseus fought with him and won using pancration, as he had no knife, goes the legend from Pindar's fifth Nemean ode. Pancration basically means total power and knowledge, but the word resonates deeper than the definition. It's associated with gods and heroes, with those who conquer by tapping every talent. Pancration is a fighting style that not only combines boxing and wrestling, but exceeds them with a savvy of its own. Some pancration techniques, like the gastrozine heel kick, have never been surpassed. "It's one of the most powerful offensive moves we've ever seen," a modern martial arts expert marveled after watching a demonstration. "The attacker's knee and foot are chambered like a piston and then stomped into the opponent's stomach, genitals or thighs. It channels some 2,000 pounds of force into the opponent, more than enough to break a baseball bat." The scariest thing about pancration is when it's not scary at all. The ready position is so nonchalant and relaxed. You could be a blink away from taking a gastrozine to the knee, and never suspect the person across from you is poised to attack. If you're set to play catch with a toddler, you're set to fight pancration. Just face forward, dip your knees, and raise your open hands. It looks less like art and more like an accident, which speaks to pancration's ancestral authority. It feels so natural because it is. Pancration refines raw impulse, chucking out everything that doesn't help, and focusing on the three things that do: ease, surprise, and stopping power. You activate without thinking, attack without signaling, and strike, like any other animal in a fight for its life, without mercy. Pancration is so frighteningly true to real violence that for years it wasn't included in the original Olympics. To get his opponent down and by throttling, pummeling, biting, kicking, reduce him to submission is the natural instinct of the savage or the child, explained E. Norman Gardner, Doctor of Letters, the Oxfordian ancient sports specialist. But this rough and tumble is not suitable for athletic competition. It is too dangerous and undisciplined. Pancration finally made it into the 33rd Olympic Games in 648 BC, with two rules: no biting, no eye gouging. Otherwise, it was anything goes. The entire range of human cruelty and creativity were at your disposal. The Spartans still grumbled and refused to participate. If you can't blind your opponent and chomp his nose, then what's the point? But for everyone else, Pancration became the most exciting and worthiest of all sports in ancient Olympia. As the Greek chronicler Philostratus put it, even though some bouts didn't last much longer than a sneeze. There were no points or pins. You won as soon as you put the other guy into unbearable agony. One champion won three Olympic titles by getting really good at snatching his opponent's fingers and bending them back. Matches could end only in death, submission, or, as in one epic contest, both. The great champion, Arahian, was in a chokehold when he managed to grab his opponent's foot. Ankle breaking is a classic Pancration move, and so effective that thousands of years later, it would be the reason the twins protected their feet by never risking anything higher than a crotch kick. But Arahian locked on too late. His opponent begged for mercy, forfeiting the match, but not before Arahian suffocated. Victory went to the dead man. Pancration's creation myth is peculiar, and not just because it has two. Storytellers couldn't agree on the original event. Was it Theseus against the Minotaur, or Hercules versus the Nemean lion? But they were unanimous on one key quirk. While boxing and wrestling were fruits of the gods passed down from Apollo and Hermes, Pancration was born from human weakness. Theseus was just a boy out to prove himself when he went to Crete, and Hercules wasn't exactly the hulking he-man we've come to assume. Hercules was never the strongest guy in the fight. In fact, Pindar even went hard the other way and chalked Hercules' achievements up to little man syndrome. Hercules was of short stature with an unbending will. The heroes were still plenty powerful, but muscle alone would never get them out of a jam. Their real strength was their ears. Theseus and Hercules were lifelong learners and equal opportunity students, always seeking advice, and just as happy to get it from women. That was the mark of a hero, and the signature of Pancration: total power and knowledge. And that knowledge has been around a long time. History actually has a dog in the fight in the Battle of the Pancration myths. When archaeologists cracked open sealed caves on Crete, the site of Theseus's showdown with a Minotaur, they discovered pottery and wall paintings from 1700 BC with the earliest depictions of Pancration. King Minos really did rule Crete, and his ships often returned from Egypt with hot new discoveries, like the peculiar Hittite religious rituals of bull leaping, boxing, and grappling. On Crete, these rites were honed into martial arts, then exported to mainland Greece. Naturally, Anything involving total power and knowledge was irresistible to a combat scientist like Alexander the Great, who still slept with the Iliad under his head. Alexander became a true believer as soon as he saw his best Macedonian warrior defeated by Deoxippus, a Pancratian fighter from Athens. Alexander's armies learned Pancratian, and as they marched east into Persia and India, it's believed Pancratian spread toward Asia and became the inspiration for all modern martial arts. So, no Ingmui? No Five Elders? No Cat-Womping Crane? Nope. There's no evidence that the origin myth of Wing Chun is any more real than the Minotaur. But just because it's make-believe doesn't mean it's not true. Wing Chun took the crucial elements of Pancratian and improved the backstory. If you're really out to prove that natural movement and elasticity can make anyone a fearsome fighter, don't use a couple of monster-killing heroes to make your case. Use a fighting nun on the run from an evil dynasty. Ingmui wasn't dreamed up just to repackage Greek fashion for a Chinese audience. Rather, it took Pancratian off the battlefield and away from the oiled and naked manly games and steered it back to its original message, that when it comes to real strength and self-defense, muscle power isn't the path. Despite the revamp, the art that could help everyone was taught to almost no one. Dynasty warfare and clan secrecy kept it underground in China, while for everyone else it was ruined by the Romans. Under the Caesars, Pancratian was degraded into a gladiatorial spectacle and became so savage it was eventually banned by the Christian emperors. No one really had the stomach after that to revive something so closely associated with the blood-crazed Colosseum. It may be suggested that the Pancratium is too terrible to serve any useful purpose in these modern times, conceded a British sportsman who failed to bring Pancratian back to life in 1898. And so, the greatest Olympic sport faded away and vanished. Except on the island where it was born. In the mountains of Crete, Pancratian was passed down between generations of rebels who never forgot what it could do and why it was created. After the German invasion, an odd photo made its way back to British intelligence. It showed three German soldiers being ambushed by a trio of Cretan freedom fighters, one of whom has his legs scissored around a German's back. It's classic Pancratian, and exactly the message the twins were trying to get across to their students back in the dirty trickster training camps. All the strength, speed, and suppleness you need, you already have. You just need to release it. Chapter 13. The name of Crete is for me, the man who conquered it, a bitter memory. Luftwaffe General Kurt Student. Crete was the perfect test. The mountains were honeycombed with caves, and with all those German supply planes transiting through on their way to Russia, the targets were ripe. But the firm couldn't go in blind. Someone first had to find out whether George Sikundakis and the rest of the Cretans really wanted to take a bunch of amateurs under their wings. If not, the Brits wouldn't last a week. So within days of his escape from Crete, Jack Smith Hughes was asked to head back. Returning a man to the same island he'd spent 7 months trying to get off was harsh, but what choice was there? The Battle of Crete had lasted 10 days, but the battle for Crete was just getting started. Hitler needed to lock the Cretans down, but he couldn't quite stop them. The Russian attack was already months behind schedule, but instead of speeding every available man to the Eastern Front, 5 entire divisions were still chasing shepherds around that Gottverdammten island. Brilliant. This was exactly what Churchill had been hoping for, that somewhere a band of irregulars would catch the giant off guard and make it stumble. Before the British even had a chance to get the firm off the ground and spread its own resistance operation, One had suddenly burst into existence by itself. The Cretan resistance, unlike those underground movements in the rest of Europe, which did not start to develop until a year or so after the German occupation, began literally in the first hour of the invasion, noted Anthony Beevor, who would write the definitive history of the Battle of Crete. As if they'd been rehearsing it for years, the Cretans quickly assembled armed militias, mountain-running messengers, and a folk song emergency alert system. Any time a German patrol was spotted, a warbling tune would pass from villager to villager across the valley and up to where their men were hiding in the hills. But realistically, how long could the Cretans withstand the fury of General Kurt Student, who, for once, was even more enraged than Hitler? The Führer had ordered his troops to terrorize the upstarts, but Student wanted more than just fear. He wanted blood. The Germans had lost more troops in the Battle of Crete than in France, Yugoslavia, and Poland combined. Student himself had almost committed suicide, and all because of those savages. The Cretans were beasts and assassins, Student decreed, who should be treated like all dangerous animals. Anywhere a hint of rebellion was detected, Student ordered extermination of the male population of the territory in question, and total destruction of villages by burning. There wouldn't even be the pretense of a trial. All these measures, Student commanded, must be taken rapidly and omitting formalities. Freed from any restraint, the Germans on Crete erupted in a rampage of revenge. In the town of Castelli Cusamu, 200 men were selected at random and slaughtered. In tiny Fornes, 140 more. Entire villages were surrounded by tanks and put to the torch, with women and children running for their lives into the mountains. Not that every woman escaped. Many had their dresses torn down, and if a shoulder bruise was spotted that could have come from a rifle recoil, they joined their brothers and husbands in the death pit. The manhunt was pitiless and relentless. German foot soldiers ransacked farms and towns, while recon planes growled low over the mountains, machine-gunning anyone who looked suspicious and snapping aerial photos of every visible cave and goat trail. So one night in October, Jack boarded a camouflaged trawler and returned to Crete with a promise. He slipped into a black blouse and pantaloons to disguise himself as a shepherd. Well, sort of.
Anyone could pick him out as an Englishman from a mile away, especially when he was dressed in those clothes,
grimaced George Sikandakis, who once again stepped in to sneak Jack past German patrols. Together they trekked up the cliff to see Abbot Laguvados, the 300-pound, fire-breathing, friar-tuck-like head of the Preveli Monastery. From there, they visited the hideouts of local resistance fighters, Beowulf and old Uncle Petrarchus, and Satan Grigorakis, so nicknamed because only the devil could have survived all the bullets in him. If the Cretan fighters could hang on a little longer, Jack told them, they wouldn't be alone. Britain's new masters of mayhem were just about ready for action. Jack had just returned from this recon mission to Crete when a penniless young painter named Alexander Fielding was brought to meet him. "Call me Chan," the fellow said, pronouncing it Chan. Chan's father was a major in the 50th Sikh Regiment, so as the son of a career soldier, Chan had known exactly what to do when the war broke out. Run and hide. "My first reaction," Chan would admit, "was flight. He'd done a pretty good job of it, too. Before the war, he tried making a living by sketching diners in fancy London cafes. Then he pushed east to study German classics and take up painting. When Hitler invaded Poland and most of Chan's university friends stepped forward to enlist, Chan stayed put in Cyprus, where he'd landed a nice gig as a bar manager. I was not afraid of fighting," Chan recalled, "but I was appalled by the prospect of the army. Did anyone seriously expect him to shove into an officer's mess 3 times a day and make small talk with a guest list not of his choosing? I could not bear the idea of an enforced and artificial relationship with a set of strangers chosen to be my comrades, not by myself, but by chance, he complained. Call me a coward.